I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Men live shorter lives than women, are less likely to see the doctor, and die at higher rates for 9 of the top 10 causes of death. What's up with that? Today, we'll look at how being macho can be bad for your health and why preventable health problems persist for men everywhere. Then, if you've ever listened to NPR's Morning Edition, Weekend Edition, or Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you've heard the work of this man. We'll chat with BJ Lederman, who has now stepped out with an album of his own music. We'll close things out with a weekend to-do list. Join us on Up to Date after this hour's news. With June being Men's Health Month, let's take a look at one measure of men's health, and it doesn't look so good. Males live significantly shorter lives than their female counterparts across all races and ethnicities, and males die at higher rates for 9 of the top 10 causes of death. Let me say that again. Males die at higher rates than women for 9 of the top 10 causes of death. One factor that may contribute to that is that men are not afforded the same preventative health benefits as their female counterparts. That means they go to the doctor less often than women and are less likely to have health insurance. Now, a conversation about why this is and how to convince that male significant other in your life to go see a doctor. With us today is Dr. Mary Himmelstein. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the UConn Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. She studies health and social psychology in the areas of weight, stigma, and masculinity. And she joins us now from WNPR Studios in Hartford, Connecticut. Doctor, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Joining me here in studio is Dr. Eugene Lee. He's a urologist at the University of Kansas Health System. And Dr. Lee, welcome to you too.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Dr. Himmelstein, what are the primary reasons that men are less likely to go see a doctor than women?
Well, so my research focuses on masculinity. So it looks at how much men value ideals of toughness and bravery and being self-reliant and non-emotional, and how that contributes to barriers from helping them seek health care. So some of my work shows that the more that you endorse those ideals, the more barriers you have to getting health care, which means the longer you wait to get health care when you are sick or injured, and the more likely you are to avoid preventative care. I also have some research looking at what men say in the doctor's office to actual doctors versus what they'll say in private and self-reports.
Yeah.
And men who endorse masculinity are also less likely to be as honest as possible with their doctors. So they tend to minimize their symptoms when they're in an office, which impairs doctor-patient communication as well.
We'll talk a little bit more about all these things. Dr. Lee, you're a urologist, so you see this kind of male behavior day in and day out. What do you notice in your practice as you go about your work?
So you're absolutely right. I think the prototypical guy who has been sitting on a medical issue for 2 years finally comes into the doctor. And once you kind of break down that barrier and you say, okay, this is an issue, we can do some testing, and then they start becoming anxious. And I think that's a very typical male pattern of medical problems. Mm-hmm. And so we see that oftentimes in clinic. You know, I think once you break down that barrier of that male masculinity and you make them a little bit vulnerable, and then I do think that they start to trust in you and then are more open to some of those testing and early diagnosis and starting to open up to you about their symptoms. I think it's very helpful.
Dr. Lee, how often do you think to yourself when a new patient comes in the door, man, I wish you would come in 6 months earlier or a year and a half earlier than what they did?
So I see that all the time. I specialize in cancer care at KU. And so, you know, there are so many disease processes that the earlier you detect them, the better off you're going to be, the better survival you're going to have.
A lot of guys put these things off.
Correct. And I do also think that there's some misinformation out there as well, too. Case in point is the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, is a test that has had so much controversy, especially of recent. And, you know, there's studies that go back and forth. The United States Preventive Services Task Force came out with recommendations a few years back saying we shouldn't be doing PSA screening. But what we know is that it is the best test that we have thus far for prostate cancer screening, and that the literature that governing body used, there were some flaws to it. And so I think overall, you're absolutely right. If men were educated better, if they would come in sooner, go see their primary care doctors and trust them, I think it'd be beneficial.
Dr. Lee, just one other thing, just to put all the cards on the table here, the kinds of tests that you do to men, a lot of men don't want to go through that stuff. They don't want to see Dr. Lee. They don't want Dr. Lee doing what Dr. Lee has to do. And how big of a factor is that in all this?
I think it is a big factor. People are always scared of the unknown, and when they hear about somebody doing a digital rectal exam, or some men, even just the simple blood test is scary for them. And so I think that is a factor in terms of coming in and getting screened. But there's certainly some fear factor in that.
Mary, one study I saw said that men with a strong sense of masculinity, and you've already referred to this, are about 50% less likely than their not-so-macho peers to seek out preventative healthcare services. Tell us about that.
So if you really believe in these ideals that you're not supposed to show weakness, that you're supposed to be tough, you wait a long time to get preventative care. And it helps if individuals have a partner who can encourage them to go to the doctor. But certainly waiting for preventative care is an issue because, right, that's where you would find out if you have elevated levels on, say, a blood test or any kind of problems with your health, right? If you miss the preventative screening, you could be missing something serious.
That study was done, I just referred to, is by Kristen Springer, and it's a few years old now. But she found that lower-paid masculine workers were, in fact, more likely to see a doctor than, say, macho managers and executives. Does that make sense to you, Mary?
It does. So one of the things we know about socioeconomic status is it tends to be protective for health. But when you pair it with masculinity, you actually lose that protection, which is a pretty big deal. SES is a big protective factor for health.
Dr. Lee, I'm wondering what wives and significant others and sons and daughters can say to a father who's reluctant to go see a urologist. What kinds of things need to be said to sort of kickstart this process and move things down the road?
I think a big part of this is that, you know, there is a lot of denial that happens, and there's a lot of men out there who have symptoms of disease that they know that that's there in the back of their mind, and they refuse to go. And I think I would say to the loved ones out there that if your, you know, husband or son or brother is complaining of something on a regular basis, that you really encourage them and push them to go see the doctor, because again, at the earliest signs of symptoms, oftentimes you can be treated appropriately.
And sometimes the trick here is that even if you're not experiencing symptoms, you still ought to be going.
You
need tests, and you need those things to catch things before symptoms start showing up.
You're absolutely right. Everybody
That's a harder sell, right?
Yeah. Everybody should have a primary care provider that they go to see on a regular basis, absolutely.
Let me get our listeners involved here. We're wondering what their sense is as to why some men are more reluctant to visit a doctor. How do you convince an important man in your life to go see one, maybe when they're not so inclined to do so? 816-235-2888 is the phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dr. Himmelstein, I'm wondering about some other metrics as well. What about when a man begins to feel sick and how long they wait before going to see a doctor compared to women? I'm guessing that men take a while longer.
So in general, men are more likely to wait when they're sick or injured, usually by a few days. When you add masculinity into it, for women, if you also endorse those ideals of toughness and bravery, you actually see really similar patterns.
Oh, really?
The difference is that for men, you have this underlying cultural expectation that you're supposed to be tough and non-emotional, and women don't really have that. So that's where the difference comes in.
And Mary, how about whether men prefer male or female doctors and the interactions they're willing to have with those doctors? What do we know about that whole idea?
Yep. So if you are a tough guy and you think that male men make more competent doctors than women, you want a male doctor. But then when you
Do people actually ask for that? Do some men say, no, I want a male doctor?
Well, so it's a little bit more complicated than that. So most of the time, if you ask men directly, do you want a male doctor or a female doctor, they say, oh, it doesn't matter. But then if you look at who they actually make appointments with, it's a very low percentage of people booking appointments with female doctors for men. I think it's something like 30%, but don't quote me on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you actually look at what they do in interaction with doctors, you look at what they say in private on, say, a self-report questionnaire, and then what they say to a male or a female doctor, and we find that these high masculinity men actually disclose less to a male doctor than to a female doctor, even though they want a male doctor more.
That's interesting. Dr. Lee, does that make sense to you based on your own practice?
It does. I mean, as a urologist, we're dealing with very sensitive topics for male health in general, erectile dysfunction, Peyronie's disease, curvature of the penis, ejaculatory dysfunction. Those are things that oftentimes men are a little hesitant to speak with females about in general and female physicians.
We're talking about why men don't go to the doctor as often as women, why men are more reluctant. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to some phone calls here. And Rick from Overland Park. Rick, good morning.
Hi there, Steve.
Go ahead, Rick. Yeah.
So I wanted to mention that on the note of masculinity, I think especially with being a masculine man, there's this work culture that masculine men feel this pressure that they have to work all the time and they can't take days off and they can't take sick days for their kids. And even just taking an hour out of your day to go see that doctor, that can help you out in such a way that it's so hard to overcome. So many people, including myself, find that time hard to make for yourself. It's so hard to step away from work and go do something for yourself.
Mary, what do you think about that, Mary?
Well, so one thing you can do is find a care center that has longer hours. So, for example, the doctor my husband and I see is also an urgent care center. So they have appointments that you can book into 9 p.m. So that can make it easier. They can be certainly harder to find offices with longer hours, but that's one thing that individuals could do if they don't want to take time off of work or they can't take time off of work.
Yeah, Dr. Lee, what do you say about this idea that men are too busy to go? I mean, that goes so far, but we men have things to do, too. We got to go in and see the doc, don't we, sometimes?
I think along the lines of that masculinity and providing for our families and being that tough guy, taking an hour out of your day right now may save maybe 5, 10, 15 years of your life in the long run that you can provide for your family. And I think you have to take that into consideration. So absolutely, it's definitely worth taking that time off of work right now.
Rick, does that help?
I think that's a great point. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it. Mary, bottom line this for us, how much longer do women tend to live than men in this country? Do we have some overall statistics there?
Yep, it's about 5 years. So if you look at overall life expectancy, it's 78 for everybody, but 81 for women and 76 for men.
What do you think about that disparity there? That's a lot of years.
It is a lot of years. I mean, I think it's terrifying, right? Like, I want to have the men in my life with me as long as possible.
Dr. Lee, does that all suggest that there's this lack of preventative care that men are taking advantage of, or are there simply biological differences between men and women that would begin to speak to the fact that women are going to live longer?
So I think you hit it right on the head, is that it is multifactorial. I think all of the topics that we've discussed thus far in terms of preventative care and going to see the doctors play a role, I think there are biologic factors. In fact, in a disease process that I take care of, bladder cancer, men are overwhelmingly more affected by bladder cancer than women, and it's traditionally because of the higher rate of smoking historically, which is the number one cause of bladder cancer. And so those types of risk factors play a role in terms of men versus females as well, too.
In theory, should men and women, Dr. Lee, live the same amount of time?
Theoretically, yes. With good health care and good preventative care, that's what we want.
So there's no other. I mean, there are these factors out there, but in theory, men should be living as long as women.
Sure. Yes.
Yeah. I'm all for it, by the way. I endorse that idea.
I agree. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. What are some of the other downsides of masculinity when it comes to getting good health care and holding men back from getting the care they need?
So I think it's, again, being willing to be open and honest with care providers. And then outside of the healthcare setting, which you touched on a little bit, is risk behaviors. So one of the things we know about masculinity is that masculine men are much more likely to take risks. So to do things like smoke, to drink excessively. And those are things that certainly affect your other health outcomes. Mm-hmm. So even outside of the health arena, it's looking at risk behavior as well.
And Mary, when these masculine men talk to doctors, they're less likely, what, to describe just how much pain they're in sometimes, right?
Yep. So they minimize that. So if you ask them, tell me about your symptoms on a scale of 1 to 5, and you do it in a self-report questionnaire, they're actually going to give you a higher score on the self-report. And then when they go into the office, it's a lower score when they're reporting to an actual person.
And that would be because why?
I think because it's hard to appear weak in front of other individuals, and I think that's really what's driving that association. When you're in front of someone, it's a different experience than if you're just sitting, filling out a piece of paper.
And Dr. Lee,
so I think when you're – yeah, go ahead.
Dr. Lee, you see this all the time, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think I agree with her 100%. Men tend to downplay the symptoms that they're having, and oftentimes it's the partner in the room that says, no. You've been telling me about this all week long. You got to tell the doctor. Yeah. And then they finally kind of coax it out of them. So we see it on a daily basis.
You know, Brian called to ask this question. What hospitals are you associated with, and do they offer specialized health care units for men like they do for women? Does the health care industry care about men's health? Dr. Lee?
So I work primarily out of the University of Kansas Hospital on 39th and Rainbow. I have a primary practice also at the Cancer Center in Westwood as well, too. Mm-hmm. And in terms of men versus female units, no, not that I'm aware of in terms of for men in particular.
Do women at the KU Hospital have their own specific unit? Yeah.
The Women's Heart Center, yeah.
Mary, is that typical? Do many hospitals have centers set aside for women and they don't have them for men?
You know, I'm not as familiar with that. I would think if it was women's centers, it would probably be focused on women's health, as in maternity kinds of care. But I'm not familiar with hospital settings in terms of gender differences for centers.
You know, Mary, we were talking a minute ago about this idea of men being reluctant to really describe how much pain they're in. When it comes to, you know, I can imagine for some men that becomes very problematic. I'm thinking about like a male athlete, for instance, who winds up suffering more serious injuries because they're playing through the pain or what have you. And you can extrapolate that might apply to men who do construction jobs and that kind of thing.
Yep. So we have a study looking at Division I athletes in college, how often they're injured, how serious their injuries are, and how likely they are to report them to their coaches or their trainers. And we found that masculinity is associated with more severe injuries for men and less willingness to tell their coach about their injury or their trainer. And we also looked at women and didn't find that association. Hmm. And so I definitely think that would also apply to the professional sport grade and certainly to jobs like construction.
Let's go back to some calls. Gail, good morning. You're on Up to Date.
Good morning. I just thought this was interesting. Took a course in medical sociology a while ago, and a professor told us that married men live longer than single men, but single women live longer than married women. Anybody want to make a comment on that? And I'll just listen on the radio.
Yeah. Thank you, Gail. That's a tongue twister there. Dr. Lee, Mary, anyone want to hop in here?
Sure, I can. So we definitely know that marriage confers benefits, and probably why you're seeing gender differences there is that there's a moderator in there, which means that there's another variable that can change that. So, for example, marriage is certainly beneficial for health, but only if it is a, quote, good marriage, meaning it's not fraught with fights. But we do know that marriage helps men in particular for health status.
So bottom line here, Dr. Lee, what should men walk away with here in terms of preventative care? What would you advise here, sort of some parting advice?
So one of the things that I did want to say is also that oftentimes men have symptoms and they are wrought with anxiety and they go see the doctor and then we can relieve some of that anxiety as well too. So it goes the other way where we can help people to relieve that anxiety. I think in general, finding a primary care provider that you trust that will sit down and talk to you about all of the preventative care tools that are available to them and working through all of that together is very, very important for men.
Is that something you're trained to do in medical school to engender that trust in the men that you deal with? Or does it just come naturally?
It's something that you gain along the way, but there are the tools that are put into place in medical school as well, too, that teach you how to interact with patients, certain ways to sit and how to be a better listener. Because oftentimes, you know, there's a stat out there that doctors wait somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 seconds or 20 seconds, something like that, before you start interrupting the patient and starting to impart what you think they should do without actually listening to what their problems are.
Is it trickier today for a lot of doctors to spend that time given the pressures on doctors to churn through the patients and meet quotas and all that kind of stuff?
I think that's probably a longer conversation for another day, but absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of pressures from the high volume of patients and seeing as many people as possible. So sure.
Let me grab one more phone call here from Tam from Midtown. Tam, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, my sister is a urological nurse in Los Angeles at the VA. So she's dealing exclusively with soldiers and macho group. And what she says happens most often is that they'll make appointments and then not show up and about 25 to 30% of the time. So I'm wondering if that's a factor or a symptomatic of what you've been talking about.
Dr. Lee, do you have a lot of people who make appointments and then don't show up?
I think in the practice that I'm in, we are a tertiary referral center. So most of my patients have already seen an outside urologist and are being sent to us for a second opinion as a urologic oncologist. So my no-show rate from a cancer perspective is pretty low. I would say, less than 5%.
Mary, what about that? Does that make sense to you based on what you know?
Yeah, I would say it's the same factor that's driving that. So it's both making the appointment and keeping the appointment that's important.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Dr. Mary Himmelstein with the UConn Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity. Mary, thanks so much. Sure appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Dr. Eugene Lee is a urologist at the University of Kansas Health System. Dr. Lee, great job for a first time out. Just did a terrific job. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Time for a break. When we come back, a familiar name to NPR listeners, BJ Lederman, joins us. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we discussed gerrymandering and whether the court should step in when it comes to drawing congressional districts. Also, the rise and fall of a small American town. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up to date. And on the NPR One app. On tomorrow's program, the infamous post-Civil War incidents of violence in the Ozarks. Then, former Chiefs lineman Ryan O'Callaghan shares his odyssey from drug abuse and plans of suicide to living his life openly as a gay man. Well, BJ Lederman is one of a kind. He's made a huge contribution to public radio without saying a word. BJ wrote the music heard on NPR's Morning Edition, Weekend Edition, Car Talk, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His themes are among the most instantly recognizable sounds in all of public radio. Here's one of those themes right now. We've talked to BJ before about his theme music, but today we're talking about a new project of his that sounds like this. That track is Walking Down the Street from B.J. Lederman's debut album titled What Else, B.J.? B.J. Lederman, welcome back to Up to Date. So good to have you.
Steve, it's great to be back with you. So strange to hear my album on the radio. I never thought anybody would play the album. It's getting played everywhere. It's really crazy.
That's a great song, Walking Down the Street, but isn't it about jumping off the Empire State Building, BJ?
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's a fantasy. It's a comic book type of song. It's, I tell people, you know, when it's basically about me and how I felt when I lived in New York and my girlfriend dumped me. I felt like going up on the top of a building and jumping off. It ends well, though. You know, when you jump off the building in a song in the first verse, you kind of scare people. But the whole trip down, it's, you know, you go into slow motion and I'm looking into this window and that window and seeing what's going on. It ends well. It's a comic ending and everything turns out fine. So don't worry.
Well, I've got to ask you, what took you so long? I mean, wasn't this album supposed to be out a while ago?
Yeah, yeah.
But you work to your own, your own rhythms, right, BJ?
Oh, yeah. You know, necessity is the mother of invention for me. And I realized that if I waited any longer, I was going to be dead. And by the way, your segment preceding me.
Yes.
Thanks for telling me I'm going to be dead sooner than later. I appreciate that, Steve.
Well, just go to the doctor and you won't be, BJ. That was the whole point. Go to the doctor.
Yeah. Hey, I live at the doctor, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Wasn't this album originally going to be called National Public Lederman instead of its current title, which is BJ?
Yeah, almost. I was calling it. Yeah, look, I would have called it NPR. I wanted to call this. I wanted to call it Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, but you know, I called Yoko and she wouldn't have it. And by the way, so it was going to be called Natural Public Lederman. Uh-huh. And for 3 years, I was using NPR's three color bar logo, you know, that they use. And about 2 months before the album comes out, 2 months. They call me up and it was a very nice phone call and I was ready to change it. I knew that there would be a problem.
Yeah.
And to tell the truth, it's good that I, you know, sort of pivoted to BJ, and the cover photo is this really wonderful photo by Paul Howie, a photographer and journalist here in Asheville. Mm-hmm. And it sort of let me distance myself and sort of cut the umbilical a little bit from NPR, because there's some message stuff on this album. And as I go forward, oh boy, am I going to give people a piece of my mind. So I think NPR is going to be embarrassed that they ever knew me, if they aren't already.
What kind of messages are you talking about?
Oh, you know, I people don't realize that I am not and have never been an NPR employee. But after almost four decades of my theme music being associated with all these NPR shows, mm-hmm. you know, and I am so fortunate that I am connected with NPR and not some other. Can't even mention the others because, you know, we're head and shoulders above the rest here. But people think I am an NPR employee. So when I use my personal mouthpiece, you know, I'm still a person on the planet in the United States, and I have my views, and I want to move the ball forward, meaning inclusive, progressive, mm-hmm. Everybody, big tent. And when I see what's going on in this country, I told Scott Simon this, you know, the member stations, the news organizations at the member stations, the news department at NPR, you guys spend, you know, millions of dollars and all this time and energy trying to make sense of the world. And, you know, in my short, brief time on the planet, I've learned nothing makes sense at all here. So,
and you want to explain that in your album, right? Yeah.
Timothy Leary. Yeah. So I've sort of given up, and some of the stuff on the album is message stuff. It's my heart, and the other stuff, like Walking Down the Street, are just frivolous, you know, as John would say about Paul songs, you know, granny music.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to another track here from BJ. This is the opening track, and it's called Sometimes.
Sometimes I think of all the times, I think about the times I'm thinking about nothing else but you. You know, it seems so very hard to go about my busy day, but I've got nothing else to do. Your face committed to my memory. My life just isn't what it used to be.
You know, BJ, it's so unusual for an artist who's, you know, not a TV or a movie star to come out with a debut album with a name known to so many millions of Americans. How big of an edge does that give you here?
Well, you know, it doesn't give me as big of an edge as if I were, you know, say Mick Jagger. I'm not getting the exact same benefits that Mick Jagger is getting, but it, you know, I do have a brand. It sure does help. You know, all my friends are out there, and I call them the work week troubadours. They've been in clubs, you know, weekend in and weekend out,
right,
since they were in their teens, you know, sweating and playing their stuff. And some of them put out albums, and you know, they have to really kill themselves to get light shown on those albums. And I'm fortunate, you know, to have this crazy name and a connection with NPR. Can I tell you who you were listening to there, by the way? The album, because I don't have this information on the album, but it will be on my website. The backup band for my album is the Randall Bramlett Band from Athens, Georgia. Randall is a wonderful singer-songwriter in his own right. He's amazing. The band is amazing. Randall just came out with an album, by the way. You might want to check that out. And also on the album, Bela Fleck had...
I was going to ask you.
Yeah, Bela appears on three instrumentals that I wrote in the 80s. And I met him a couple of years ago at the Leaf Festival. It's kind of a wonderful mini Woodstock thing we have here twice a year in Nashville. And went backstage, and he said, "Yeah, I know who you are, BJ." I said, "You want to listen to some of these instrumental cuts I did when I didn't know what I was doing?" And he said, "Yeah." So he picked three of them and played on top of them. So I'm
great.
Very lucky.
So what was tougher for you, writing the theme to Morning Edition or writing that tune we just heard that was titled Sometimes?
Boy, that's a good question. By the way, nice edit, guys. I've never heard anybody play an edited version of my song, but whoever edited that has got great rhythm.
Yeah.
I think, you know, both of them were easy. I gotta tell you, Morning Edition came in like 5 minutes, on my mother's piano when I went home from American University on spring break. And sometimes, you know, so you sit at the piano. Sometimes I don't even have to sit at the piano. It just, like McCartney says, you actually do wake up sometimes with a tune in your head, like a dream. And, you know, he was struggling with, I guess it was yesterday. He didn't think that he'd written it. You know, he ran it by John and the other Beatles. And they said, "No, we haven't heard it before." So I just walking around, I'm whistling something. And sometimes I go, you know, open up my iPhone and hit the recorder and hum it into there and then deal with it later when I'm at the piano.
You've got so much in common with the Beatles. That's a nice connection to have, BJ.
Oh, I tell you, Steve, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day. I said, I wish I was born a little earlier. I wish I was like 30 or 40 in the 60s. Things were so much simpler then. And I could have seen the Beatles, maybe. I could have gone to Woodstock.
Yeah.
You know, my parents wouldn't let me go anywhere. So I think I was a little late, but the Beatle connection is critical, because if my dad had not brought home Meet the Beatles from his department store, and if they hadn't sat me down in front of the TV and said, "Look, these guys are pretty interesting, BJ, you might want to watch this," I wouldn't be talking to you right now.
You know, you've said that your life has been one lottery win after another. Why do you say that?
I've gained an appreciation for the good things that have happened to me in my life. You know, I have been lucky, but I've also been lucky to have been at these coordinates of right place at the right time and actually have a little some ammunition to deal with it, you know. The Beatles did give me, you know, we learned every Beatles song that came out, me and my friend David Lively on drums. And we had this little band called the Lively Sound Dimension in elementary school. You figure out what the initials are.
Yeah.
And and so when you are a student of the Beatles like that, we didn't know we were students. We just learned everything record faithful. And you get a great education in songwriting and harmony and melody, and it just sort of was a natural flow We didn't know it was happening to us, you know?
Well, let's listen to a little more from this album from B.J. Lederman of NPR fame. He mentioned he did some work here on this album with Bella Fleck. This is B.J. Lederman and Bella Fleck. This is Bella B.J. Part 3. B.J. Lederman, Bela Fleck here. To what extent was this album a bucket list thing for you, B.J.?
It was absolutely bucket list.
You had to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I start things all the time, Steve. I've got a million projects that are, you know, scribbled on index cards or on my computer that I haven't finished. And I wake up one day and look in the news, you know, the papers, find out that someone else has done it. And, you know, nobody else could have done this thing but me. So I figured, and also there's a bunch of people back in my hometown of Virginia Beach, hi guys, that would have killed me if I didn't put the thing out.
Yeah. Well, let's go out with one final track. This is the last track from the album. It's titled Weekend Perdition. And I think people,
oh God,
they're going to recognize the theme here. BJ, what a pleasure. Good luck with the album, and thanks for taking time with us today.
Steve, I appreciate you checking in. And I hope you enjoy the album Kansas City, because I enjoy Kansas City when I come there. I'll see you soon.
You bet, BJ. Take care.
Show me the money.
Were we rolling, I hope?
Coming up next, Brian McTavish. Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend, and you know the song, the words to every, you know the words to every bit of that song.
I know the words.
I'll get it right. That's Joe Jackson.
Oh, ho, ho. I'm telling you, man.
Who was big when I was a kid.
Oh, well.
And he's back. He's still here.
You mean when you were 21?
When I was 21.
Were you just a kid when you were 21?
Yes, I was. Boy, was I.
Whoa, yeah. I'm telling you, this will take you back, and this will put you where you need to be, whether you were there at the beginning or not.
And you like it.
Jackson.
You're just bouncing all over the place.
I think I've damaged the furniture, frankly. Anyway, yes. It's the former late 70s new wave rocker and then some. Who was once hailed as the next Elvis Costello.
What happened? I haven't heard from him in a long
time. Well, he's been moving right along. He makes records, he tours, and he did not succumb to the pressure of being compared to Elvis Costello. It's like these singer-songwriters over the years who show up and, oh, he's the next Dylan. It's the kiss of death. Anyway, Joe Jackson did not die. He is moving ahead, stronger than ever. He is he's going to put on a great show, I just know it, at 8 o'clock Friday night.
At the Uptown.
At the Uptown Theater. You're going to hear that, I am sure. That's from his 1979 album, I'm the man, and he is still the man. You'll hear, is she really going out with him? You'll hear, look sharp. You'll hear all the stuff that you want to hear if you're a Joe Jackson fan.
Wow, that sounds great.
He's great.
Mama Mia, here I go again. Mama, how can I resist her? Mama Mia, does it show again? Mama, just how much I missed her. Yes, I'll be broken hearted. Blue since the day we parted. Why did I ever let you go? Mama Mia, now I really know. Mama, I could never let you go.
ABBA. They're still with us. They never leave us.
Well, we're still here. Why
we're
not?
We're still here.
Okay. Are you an ABBA fan?
Not especially, but
okay.
They're catchy
You're
stuff.
The perfect person to check out Mamma Mia, 8 o'clock Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at Starlight Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, if you're an ABBA fan, if you're all into Dancing Queen and Super Trooper and The Name of the Game and SOS and The Winner Takes It All and Take a Chance on Me
and
a lot of other ABBA hits from the 70s and 80s.
There were so many. Too many.
I thought I was picking up on there.
Yeah.
Okay, but if you love all that stuff, there's no way you don't love Mamma Mia. Plot, who needs a plot? You know, it's about love found and lost and found again, and there's multi-generations involved, and there's some big wedding at
the
end.
It's about the music, you're saying.
It's about the music. But getting back to my original pseudo point, you, sir, I can take him or leave him. You are perfect fodder for this show because you will be carried away on a cloud of joy. I'm telling you right now.
Get out of here.
Through the weekend, it's ABBA mania. It's ABBA dabba doo at Starlight Theater. You like that one, huh? Maybe we should work that in. Okay.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 profound things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Profound?
Absolutely.
From you, KCUR.org.
Including Mamma Mia, I make the case.
Okay. What do we have here?
What, Steve Kraske, knower of things, is indeed the greatest play ever written?
Hamlet.
And you have a cheat sheet provided.
Hamlet.
So that's good. You gave the right answer. It is indeed the greatest play ever written. You can look it up.
Just a week or two ago, I was reciting lines from this on the... I was brilliant, by the way.
Of course
I had a future on the stage. I might be going there.
Well, there's an audio record, and the listeners can go back and decide,
yes,
right?
They can.
Okay.
There's nothing to decide. I was brilliant.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so William...
The coach told me I was brilliant.
That's right. You had the Shakespeare expert
on. I had the guy.
Who
said I was brilliant.
Did he... He gave you the full...
Full thumbs up, ready for the big time.
Well, I'm surprised you're not in the Heart of America Shakespeare.
I wouldn't be able to memorize all those. That would be a problem for me. All those lines and...
Were you in school plays?
No.
Okay, I was in these school plays.
I was terrified of
your
that stuff.
Fear of memorization...
Yes, no, I
...is perhaps a bit exaggerated, but there is something to be said for being... You know, ready to go into a cold sweat on the day of the show. Because I did high school plays like many of us did.
I had to do one in sixth grade, and my line was, I like cherries. I had three words I had to say and lean out from the side of the stage. It was the big laugh line.
Yeah.
I had to, like, hold a card saying, I like cherries until the second before I went on stage.
Did you not like cherries? Is that the
problem? I did like cherries. No, that wasn't an issue. It was the words and memorizing with air quotes around that line.
At the moment of truth, you tapped into your method acting self.
And I got there.
And somehow, we still have perhaps a moment. Left to discuss.
Dorothy Lane Elementary School, Kettering, Ohio, just in case you were wondering.
God bless them.
Okay.
Yeah. Indeed, we have Hamlet, the greatest play ever written, featuring the totally Kevin Spacey-approved performance of Nathan Darrow, who shows up alongside Kevin Spacey in House of Cards. Now, how do we know Kevin liked it?
Does he like cherries?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he does. Well, yes, he does, as a matter of fact. How did you know that?
Anyway,
Kevin Spacey, you know, he's been on screen with the guy who's playing Hamlet here in this local Hamlet, and because Kevin Spacey came to town. I mean, you must have read all about this. I'm sure this was on the air in some fashion.
Yeah.
Kevin Spacey came to town to give his thumbs up to the guy playing Hamlet, who he's been on screen with before. That's a crazy, elongated way of trying to get my point across.
I didn't know Kevin Spacey came to town.
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Yes, he did. And if he didn't, forgive me, I'm misinformed. Anyway, Insanity, Homicide, Vengeance, Poetry, 7:30 nightly, all weekend at Southmoreland Park. Get your Hamlet on.
And what do we have here?
Tomorrow's geniuses in the making.
Ah.
Are you ready?
Yes.
It's Maker Faire, Kansas City. Engineers, artists, scientists, crafters, and others share their hobbies, experiments, and projects, including the Star Wars-loving featured exhibitor, one of them anyway, at Maker Faire Kansas City all weekend at Union Station. It's called the KCR2 Builders Club. And what might that be?
I don't know.
I will tell you. It is a club here in town where the members make their own versions of the sci-fi film franchises R2-D2 and other droids. So if you love Star Wars, if you love onstage science experiments and workshops and how to turn your hobby into a business, and if you like futuristic candy making, and it's going to be good, check it out Saturday and Sunday at Union Station.
And finally today.
Yep.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out with the crowd.
Big Slick. It's Big Slick weekend. All the boys are in town.
Eighth annual.
Yeah.
So we got the core
eighth
group.
Annual.
We got
wow.
the core group of the Big Slick Celebrity Weekend, right?
Yeah.
Where we've got the hometown funny men, Rob Riggle, Jason Sudeikis, Paul Rudd, Eric Stonestreet, and others. And they invite their celebrity friends to come to town.
And the list is getting bigger every year.
Oh, yeah. They bowl. They have an auction. They have a party.
And they're funny.
And they bring their Hollywood friends, and they're funny. And the best, funniest, most entertaining way to get in on Big Slick Celebrity Softball Game. That's it. The Big Slick Celebrity Softball Game. 5 o'clock Friday. It's free with a ticket to the Royals-Toronto Blue Jays game on Friday at Kauffman Stadium. And they got over 1,000 tickets left.
Thanks, Haas. I appreciate it.
Well,
1,000 tickets left. You can still go get them. Okay.
Maybe more. More, yeah. Well, thank you, Little Joe. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the show, we recall some of the most violent events in Ozarks history. Also, former KC chief Ryan O'Callaghan and the first person he told he was gay talk about his journey to coming out. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.